Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quickly. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming, and when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to. And that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finance, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Dr. Devonna Williams. Dr. Williams is, she's been a friend, I have to say, like, personal friend, because I've known her. We've been in some classes together in the Philadelphia area. But her official biography is that she founded Goins Williams Associates, Inc., which is a successful performance consulting business, in 1986 to help organizations achieve greater productivity in strategic work environments. As president, CEO of Goins Williams, Dr. Williams has contributed her talents to helping more than 50,000 individuals in hundreds of organizations increase their performance and effectiveness. GWA focuses on people, process, and performance, and works with clients to develop solutions to meet organizational and individual objectives and achieve lasting results. Dr. Williams is a frequent guest, a keynote speaker on business, diversity, leadership, motivation, and success, willfully sharing her philosophy strategies for overcoming obstacles in her career and personal challenges to live her dreams and deliver content to motivate and inspire others. She's the author of The Intentional Consultant, How to Grow a Sustainable Consulting Business, and a contributing author to the inspirational book Remarkable Women, and creator of the national best-selling Spice of Life Diversity Card Training Tool. Welcome, Devonna.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be a part of your podcast.
Good. So let's just get started with a couple great things. First of all, I want you to tell me something about this remarkable career you've had since 1986 to sustain a consulting business for all those years, when most people who get into this kind of thing, they kind of burn out after 10 years. So tell me, what's your secret to sustainability?
Well, thanks for that. It has been an evolving practice. And let me say that after 26 years, you go through a lot of changes and evolutions, but the core elements of my business have remained the same. And part of what's made it sustainable is that we've operated like a large business, in that we have a number of divisions and services in organizational development and assessment, strategic planning, and overall performance consulting work. And what that does is it gives us a lot of different lines to be able to offer to our clients. So when the market is down, for example, and the training aspect of our business sort of declines, we see a spike in requests for organizational assessments and strategic planning. And some of the work is non-cyclical. In other words, it continues throughout the year. So we've evolved over the years. We've had to become more tech savvy. We've migrated a lot of our training products so that they're online. And we've changed our delivery method from being a very classic on-site, in the office type of service to going out to the client where they are and going out often through technology. And almost all of our work is delivered now electronically, the reports that we use and so forth. So it's been a matter of staying current and evolving and keeping in touch with the trends over time. And we don't serve any particular sector, although we started out working with more Fortune 500 companies, and now we tend to work more with a mixture of companies. We've also worked with government and large nonprofit organizations as well. And all of those have different, those organizations have different business cycles and different up and down times. And that's part of what's kept us in business. So I wrote the book, The Intentional Consultant, because it came at a time during the recession when I saw a lot of people coming out into management consulting work and they did not have a plan. And I knew that one of the things that sustained us was having a strategic plan, being able to keep in touch with all of those trends and be able to evolve the way a company needs to in order to serve the marketplace.
Devana, when you started doing this, you said you started working with Fortune 500 companies. How did you make the leap from being an employee, I believe it was with DuPont? How did you make the leap from that into your own business? How did you market yourself?
I was fully committed when I went to work for DuPont, but I was one of those people that was always a strategic thinker and always seeking opportunities. I did some freelance consulting before I actually took my employment with DuPont Corporation, and I always had an eye to if something ever happens and I need to go back to what I was doing, I need to figure out how to make this a full-time practice. And so the time that I was there, I had that in my mind's eye, and when there was an opportunity to take an early retirement, which came almost as a surprise to me, I had already had a plan in my hip pocket, and I began to work on that strategic plan to launch my business full time and pick up on the part-time consulting work that I had done for a few years before I actually took work with DuPont Corporation. And so what helped me be full time was that after working in a corporation as an employee, especially at that level, I was able to have a better understanding of what I needed to do to sustain a business. And so part of my strategy was building sustainable or long-term clients that would be multi-year projects or clients, which would allow me to predict cash flow and to be able to have a full-time practice.
So you would say that you leveraged the relationships you had with DuPont into some of those connections for your own business?
Not so much with DuPont, but that I made as a result of my work with DuPont. I was very active in the community, and many people that I knew, I said, well, if I ever come out here and start doing management consulting work, remember me. Remember me. And what I did I picked up on those contacts and some of the contacts at DuPont, but it was actually several years before I did consulting work for the DuPont Corporation because I saw other people who took downsizing opportunities out of corporate America, DuPont included, and what would happen is they took that work, and when that work dried up, they didn't have any other work and no one knew who they were. And so I saw that as something that I didn't want to do, that it would be better for me to cultivate a variety of contracts and contacts and new business development that relied on my network, but also on the community organizations that I had worked with, many of whom had business and government and nonprofit contacts. And those were the ones that the individuals and business people that I went to and asked, well, what do you have for me, or who could you suggest I talk to? And I actually talked to 100 people and made a journal of the people that I talked with, and that led to immediate contracts.
And is that how you developed all of the different sleeves of the business that you have, based on what they told you, and that then determined what services you'd be able to offer?
It actually is, Lynn. What I did was I asked for some feedback from, based on the contacts that I had, about 100. And I said, based on what you know about me and the work that I've done with you, both in the community and my corporate and my government past, which I had a substantial government career before I went into work in the private sector, what do you think I could best offer as a management consultant, as a performance consultant? And based on that feedback, it actually grouped into about the five categories that I'm still currently offering in my business today.
Okay. And how did you make the transition from a direct provider of services onto an online type business? Did somebody, did you contract with somebody to do that for you, or was that something that kind of evolved from your own client base?
Well, let me just say, we're not a direct online business. I will say that we offer a lot of blended kinds of solutions. What happened is that we were a primary distributor for one of the, for our training products through the Inscape Publishing Company, and now they're the Wiley Company, and they went online. They went to online platforms because most of the customers, they saw business opportunity, but, if you might recall that, oh, I guess about the beginning of the recession, there was a huge increase in the cost of gasoline, and that had a direct impact on the training business. And,
it
sure did. And so what that company did was they started doing a lot more beta tests on their online instruments, and I participated in some of those tests. And based on that, they saw that this could be a really good market niche, but it also lent some additional opportunity of adding value to the product, because you could combine instruments in different ways, and you could aggregate data and do things with the technological advantage that you couldn't do with the paper assessments. And so that's really how that whole industry has gone. You have blended learning and, of course, webinars and that kind of thing. And so that's how it went. So that part of our business did go to online, and that allowed us to meet a lot more training requirements and remote training and blended learning opportunities. And so it was a real win-win. But I also partnered with a webmaster to help me with providing additional online type services to some of our existing customers, and to help me with our online strategy. So yes, it's one of those things. If you don't have the expertise, you definitely have to hire it or find it or partner with it. And that's been a ongoing strategy that we've used to stay in business.
That's one of the smartest things a business owner can learn to do, to know when it's time to call in the experts and when it's time to do it yourself. That's not an easy call a lot of times, but it sounds like it worked out well for you. What would you say is the number one revenue source for your business? What services are the most popular?
Most popular are the blended solutions, the organizational development performance consulting piece, where we actually stay with the client. We come in as doing an assessment for them, work with them to develop solutions. Often those solutions might include a training or professional development offering to improve the leadership, looking at organizational efficiencies, and then facilitating task teamwork and ongoing performance improvement plan. But I would say that within that, and I miss the strategic planning, probably strategic planning is the most popular, followed by focus group work that we do.
Okay. Let's talk for a minute about your book, because you and I got to know each other around the time, I think it was, that you had published the book, which obviously we can say in retrospect was brilliant timing because of what was going on in the world. But there's an interesting story that I'd like you to share with our listeners about the cover of the book and the meaning of that little tree that's on the cover of your book.
Yes, and thank you for that. The cover of the book is there's a sprig of a green plant, and it symbolizes a healthy green plant, and that's a business that's been sustained. And it's really what you have to do to sustain a business. And when you think about yourself as a gardener, and I garden, and you plant that seed and you nurture it along, and a lot of things can happen when you're gardening. And I told the story about the rabbits that I constantly fight and how I have to deal with the rabbits or chewing away at my plants. And so coming around and looking at solutions to, first you put a fence around the plant, and then you find that you water it too much, and then you say, oh, well, you can't water it so much. You probably need better soil, and you have to cultivate the soil and then make sure that it's getting the right amount of light. And even after it grows, then you have to prune it, you have to cut it back, you have to shape it. And that's pretty much how you have to treat a business. And in order to sustain your business, you have to constantly nurture and attend to it. And it's just a good metaphor for my business, because there's so many times that when I look back at my business after 26 years, a lot of things happen in the course of the time. And I can think of Y2K. I can think of 911. And what happened to our business after 9/11. And then, of course, we had the recessions in the 90s. I forgot about that. And, of course, this big, bad recession, the 2008 recession / depression. And but we managed through it and actually came out the better for it. And but just by looking at and nurturing, what is it that we have to do to stay healthy.
And what did you do when 2008 hit? How many employees did you have at the time, and did you have to shrink your workforce by some number in order to survive?
Yes, and yes, and yes. And I actually had a second office out in the Denver area, and I saw that what was happening was that fewer and fewer of our clients were willing to pay half-day per diems for training or focus group work. And for speaking events, they did not want to have travel, didn't want to pay for travel. They only wanted local speaking. And that was a red flag. I said, okay, here's a lot of red flags going up. We need to take a look at that. And that was the business out in Denver. And we had our office, our core headquarters office in Delaware. And we started to see the same kinds of things where people were only looking for work in the Delaware area. They did not want to pay for travel. And so we said, we probably need to do some things differently. And I had an office building that I was leasing out. I had employees in the Wilmington office and associates in both locations. And I had part-time people. And I made a decision to shut down the Denver office. Also made the decision to put the office buildings up for sale and to lease the building. And with the help of my CPA, made the decision that we should transition out of all full-time employees and move to an associates-only 1099 business model. And that's what a lot of the larger training and development firms were doing at the time. And I actually talked with a few, and I said, what are you doing? Do you see this recession on the horizon? And that was in 2007. And so when 2008 came, I was there. I had it was just such good timing. I was able to sell my business practice and not my business practice, I'm sorry, my building in 2007 and change my business practice so that I downsized to the one office, and I still kept the work out in Denver, but I closed the office, and I ended up just with the small part-time office, and found that I was very nimble. That allowed me to make a lot of adjustments. We saw all these adjustments come in with healthcare and just so many adjustments that I never really experienced a negative downturn, just for a short time in 2008, but it wasn't sustained.
Good for you. That's really, really a smart strategic move to see that coming, because I don't know how many people really did and got caught really off guard. And I know a lot of my peers in my business just folded and went away because they just couldn't sustain anything. So I think it's great that you saw that coming and you were able to make those moves before the rest of the world saw it coming. Kudos to you. Let me flip this around now and ask you a couple questions, which I've sent to you ahead of time, about your relationship with money. I mean, that was a good example of what you just talked about, how you saw something and you took some action and made a difference. But let's start with where you came up with your perception about your maybe the myths or the stories we've all created about money. So what was your family like when you were growing up?
Oh, our family was very organized. It was very organized, loving, and nurturing. My mother was a big organizer. There were five kids, a typical 50s, 60s kind of household. I had an older brother, and there were five children, four sisters, one brother, and 17 years difference between the oldest and the youngest.
Wow.
And yes.
And you were the oldest sister.
No, I was number four.
Oh.
I was number four. But I took on the role of, I guess, a middle sister type of syndrome, middle child syndrome, in that I was the middle of the three youngest and was a best buddy to my oldest brother and my oldest sister. So so we had a great family. My mother was an organizer. My dad worked constantly. He always had multiple jobs, three jobs usually, two main jobs and then third job. And my mother was an exceptional money manager and household organizer. And that's pretty much how I grew up. And we were responsible for ourselves and for our own behavior. And we were taught to be resourceful. And those were the things that I remember. And I remember that I never, as a child, never went without anything, and we always had extras. And so I would describe our household as a middle-class family, and we thought we had a lot more than we did.
Well, that's good, though. That's good. So what was your first memory around money?
First memory is getting paid for chores. And we had basically... We all were responsible for keeping our rooms neat, but there were extra chores that if we wanted to earn extra money, my mother was willing to pay for those chores. And so, and of course I signed up for all the chores because that's how, and I did. I from watering plants to cleaning the stove and collecting the bottles that had to be returned to the grocery store and maybe sweeping out the shed, those kinds of chores I do remember.
And didn't that make you kind of a target for your siblings who would say, hey, leave some for us?
Well, there were plenty of chores that went around, but everybody wasn't as interested in doing chores and earning as I was.
Oh, all right.
And but my oldest brother, and this is funny, my oldest brother actually robbed me of my savings. I had a special box with all of my savings, and I may have been about 8 years old, and it had a lock on it, and he jimmied the lock and took everything out and left me an IOU, and he used the money toward his elopement. He got married. And
that's so funny.
And he, but some of the money I had earned were doing chores for him too. Like washing out the bathtub. I remember that.
Very good. So did he ever pay you back?
He did, with interest. All right. With interest. He was a great brother. And what I learned was that you could lend money. I learned from that my chores, that was just a little piece of it. I learned that I could do chores for the neighbors, and I could do things that were entrepreneurial in the neighborhood. So I charged the kids to come to my puppet shows, and I would do chores for the neighbors and collect the bottles from my parents' house, but also the next few neighbors, and then walk over to the grocery store with the bottles. And so I was quite entrepreneurial, and as a young child, it carried over. I actually worked on my dad's water ice truck too. This is one of the jobs. My dad always had side businesses, and yeah. I was a willing worker. I loved working on the water ice truck, and I helped to put this is Philadelphia, so putting the mustard on the pretzels and serving water ices and collecting the sticky money from the children and putting it in my change box. And I would get a cut off of whatever run we would have, and I would put it in my savings.
I was just going to ask, then what lessons about money did you learn when you were growing up? So you learned to save money so that your brother could rob you. But besides, what else did you do with the money?
What I did was the money would go to special things. And special things to fix up my room, for example. I also helped with certain things. I bought gifts for the family, so my Christmas shopping would be. And remember, in these days, we were very independent as children. I would get on my bicycle and ride down to the avenue with my money and buy anniversary gifts for my parents or birthday gifts for my sister. And I had the money. I would have my own money. And so it gave me a sense of independence. And we were also, in our school system, we were also encouraged to save. We had the PSFS bank that we did banking in school. And so my mother would give us a little bit of money to make the deposit. I think it was once a week or something that we had the school banking. And because I was earning these little extra monies from time to time, I could make larger deposits. And that made me feel good to see that I had more savings.
Well, at least it was safe from your brother.
Yeah, yes. And then by the time I got to college, I actually had a pretty decent amount in the SFS account. I used that for my books.
Nice. What would you say are some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've made in your life?
Well, I can't think of, I really couldn't think of a lot of bad decisions. I can think of time periods where I remembered earlier parts of being a young married person that we would buy new cars too frequently. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that I learned that doesn't work very well. Now I buy a really good car and I keep it until I can't drive it anymore. And when I don't have a car note is when I'm really happy. And then I buy what I want when I'm ready to buy the next car. And
all right.
So I've learned those kinds of strategies to increase the value of your assets long term and to have a long term financial plan for personal life. And I always have had two plans, one for business and one for personal. And when you have a small business and you're an entrepreneur, they're so interrelated. I mean, they're intertwined in many cases.
Yes, they are. Yep. It's almost inseparable. What would you describe the events that have happened in your life that you would describe as defining moments?
Well, defining moments, marriage, of course. I was a young married person. I got married at 19. I was a junior in college and finished my college education. And then having my very first and only child at a very young age, at 21, defining events. I would say divorce, losing my parents, which actually happened well before I got divorced. And earning my advanced degrees, earning my doctorate, and I would say remarriage. So those are the big life events.
Those are the big ones.
And they're all stressful, you know, but they're good and they're sad and they're stressful. So you have a balance. You have some things that are life events that are really positive, but they change and impact your finances and how you live your life and how you plan for your future. And so those are the big ones that I can think of. I could spend an hour on each of those, and I know you don't want that.
That may be for a future podcast.
Right.
I can take one at a time.
Right.
But the bigger point to that is they're all defining moments. But did they make any significant shifts in your thinking about things because they happened?
Oh, absolutely. I'll say that by being married so young, and I was an independent student as a college student too. So, but being married as a young person, and my husband was young, we were very self-reliant, and we had to save. And we were able to buy our first house when we were, I was 23. And,
wow.
Had a very responsible, administrative executive job by the time I was 23. And because when you're young, a young family, young parents, and, you have financial goals. So we talked about our financial goals and we planned very well together. And we also worked on our education to know that if we wanted to advance to the next level of where we saw our careers going, we had to go back to school. And so we shared that responsibility. First my spouse went back, then I went back and continued to go back. We both ended up with the terminal degrees in our area. So I say that was very significant. When my father passed away first and then my mother passed away by the time I was 34, and I was named her executor of the estate. I also had helped out with my father, and that was a huge responsibility. And, and I learned very quickly about stocks and bonds and investments. My mother was a great investor, and how to deal with wills and all the things that you have to deal with there. And my mentor at the time, who was one of my bosses at DuPont, he was very helpful in helping me understand what I had to deal with. And so I took some education. I got involved with stockbroker and formed a relationship with stockbroker Dean Witter Reynolds, and I had to manage these accounts. I had to manage inheritance, and I had to deal with understanding what it was that I was going to do and how to manage those funds. So that was the defining moment, and I still am managing my investments today. And that a lot of that, I knew my mother was doing that, and she taught me a little bit, but it's nothing like once you're parents aren't here, then it's on you and you have to figure it out.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, that's interesting that your mother was somebody who was involved in stocks and bonds. Where did that come from for her?
She was just a money manager. She was very resourceful, good at managing money. She told us that when we had allowance, I would get the allowance, and she said, look, here's what you have, and you can be happy with that, or you can figure out how you can multiply it. And so when I was in high school, I would take the money that I was given instead of buying tokens with it to take public transportation. I would use it and buy candy and resell it to my classmates, multiply it, and I'd make use scraps from fabric and sell purses to friends. And so I could multiply my token money 5 times, 10 times the amount just by being entrepreneurial. And so my mother she knew about investing, and she read a lot. And So I guess she passed it on to me. And I have a family of entrepreneurs. My brother had a couple of businesses, too, and I actually worked for him. When I was in college, I worked for my uncle and my uncle's stores. And so I understood about what being an entrepreneur was, but I never quite knew about the stocks and bonds and the investments. And I saw that the way my mother learned was through reading. And so I started reading and subscribing to Morningstar and Wall Street Journal, and got to know, befriend my stockbroker. And that's how I developed my own education and knowledge.
That's amazing, because you are so not like most women your age, and your mother especially was, it's really something that was an anomaly, because most women in her generation really didn't know anything about money and didn't really want to know anything about money, and nor did they find any place to go and learn about money. So I just think it's incredible that your mother was able to do that and then pass that on to you. I mean, it's wonderful. What a great role model.
I would say she was ahead of her time.
Clearly.
Ahead of her time. And
absolutely.
You know, and I'll tell you that when I went through my divorce, which was very painful, there were a lot of money issues. But the one thing that my lawyer told me was, he says, you're ahead of most women in that you know what you have, you understand your resources, and you're ahead of 95% of the women that I talk with. And so I was able, I had my own, of course, credit, I owned property, and the hard part was going through the division process and trying to maintain relationships, and that was what was hardest. And the insecurity that you have when you go through a divorce.
Yep. Let's go fast forward here. Do you see yourself ever being retired?
Well, I'm kind of coming up on that age. I've been in this business now 26 years and running my own business, and I am looking at my next 5 years. And this year particularly, I've started to really seriously look at retirement planning. What is it that I want to do? And what I've decided is I don't really want to retire. I don't see myself ever retiring. But I do see myself creating opportunities where I can do more of what I like to do, and have more leisure time, and work on plum projects, and travel more, and spend more time with my family, and with community interests and my own personal interests and church and those kinds of things. So that means I don't want to work the same amount of hours. And so I'm starting to look at, how do I transition my business? How do I, what is it that I truly do want to do? And how do I evolve my business so that there's succession issues there? So I'm in the throes of that now, as well as how much, what is it that I actually need to live on? So
yeah.
I'm working on that.
Well, very good. More kudos to you for doing that. Most people just stick their heads in the sand and say, whatever happens, happens. But that's clearly not a financial plan, but it's surprising to me how many business owners never see themselves being retired. But I think there's, if not fully retired, as in I'm not making any money anymore, I'm not contributing to anything, well, then what is it that you're doing? Because it's not just 100% leisure. It's something else that will take that place. And for most of us who are business owners, it's just hard to say it's over and you walk away. There's still that entrepreneurial spirit that needs to be expressed somewhere. And so that's why I asked that question, because I'd like to hear what people say.
Well, exactly. And when you've been in business a while, and part of what I've been looking at within my business is knowledge mining. Okay, I've done all these reports and projects and studies and plans for hundreds of organizations. How do I capture that somehow? How do I mine that information? How do I share that? How do I share what it's like to run a business for 26 years? How do I do now what I want to do that's not that business? And it's some of it's your identity too that you deal with. And
So
I'm going through it. It's a transition period, but it's needed because we all need to have time to really take time to smell the roses, give back to the community. I'm a grandparent. I want to spend time with my grandchildren, with my children, my family members, and do things that I haven't had a chance to do because I've been working my whole adult life. And so I'm starting to make sure that I have time for that. But the one thing that I have done is, and I think a lot of small businesses don't do this, but I set up a retirement plan for my business in the first 5 years that I was in business. So I have this SEP plan and other investments through my business. So I actually have a retirement through Goins Williams Associates, and I have some retirement through other employment that I've had as well. So I'm not without resources, and that's something that for smaller businesses that they should really always take a look at that and make sure that they have that in place.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears. So, yes, a lot of people really do need to do that, and they don't. So I'm going to wrap this up here and say that to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from Dr. Devonna Williams, all of which can help you move your career, your life, your relationships, and your financial freedom forward. Tell us quickly, Dr. Devonna, how can people reach you?
Okay, best way to reach me is you can go to our website, which is www.goins, G-O-E-I-N-S, Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S.com. And you'll see all of our social media links there and our email address as well, info@goinswilliams.com. So please feel free to reach out. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you so much for being a part of this today. And I will say goodbye, and we will see you next time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome. Bye.
My pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.